Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Mindy Yang, and I'm an investor at Lyra Hippo in New York.
Mindy, thanks so much for making time join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and talk more about your current role, current organization, which I'm very excited about, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Yeah, for sure. So I graduated from college in 2015. I went to Yale University where I studied economics and psychology. So I never really had this kind of grand plan for finance. I kind of just decided along the way what I wanted to do. But my first job out of college was working at AIG, the large insurance company, in the M&A and strategy group. So I wanted to kind of learn a blend of the strategy side and the finance side. Turns out I wasn't super interested in insurance. So quickly needed to think about that. And started talking to a lot of people about what I could do next. So I wound up going actually to Vista Equity Partners, which is a large software private equity firm where I worked on mostly B2B software investments that were super late stage. So that was a great experience. I definitely gained a lot of my investing skills there and also learned a lot about finance. But ultimately, I kind of realized after a few years, I wanted to go early stage to work with younger companies and especially startups. So made the transition over to venture actually at the very beginning of the pandemic, which in and of itself was a pretty interesting experience, but essentially started at this firm in SF called Soma Capital, and after a year moved over to where I am now, which is Lyra Hippo in New York. So yeah, that's kind of the nutshell version.
Well, what a very diverse career you've had so far, which is very exciting. And it's interesting to hear, you know, to hear the pivots that you had to make based on some of the learning experiences, and you were not afraid at the end of the day to, I guess, experiment and try things out, which is always very motivating. So tell us a little bit more about your current role. I realize you just joined the company not too long ago. You know, from a perspective, what falls under your purview, and just a little bit of a context around that.
Yeah, definitely. So Lyra Hippo has been around for about 10 years now. We're super active investors in New York City, but we also invest all across the rest of the US as well. So from kind of a focus perspective, we're pretty generalist. Our portfolio is probably 50% consumer and then 50% enterprise, roughly. But I think a lot of people kind of know us for consumer because we backed early companies that now everyone knows, like Casper, Warby, a lot of those types of household consumer brands. So as you probably could tell from my intro, I don't really have much of a consumer background, but the reason I went over to Lyra is they were actually looking for someone to help build out more of an enterprise footprint as well. So I ended up joining, and now I kind of focus on enterprise too, in addition to looking at a bunch of consumer companies. So I would say under my purview is just broadly enterprise SaaS. I look a lot at future of work, some fintech, insurtech, as well as digital health, and all sorts of verticalized SaaS as well. So yeah, so firm itself, pretty generalist. We definitely look at a bunch of stuff at the seed stage, but I'm more personally focused on B2B software.
Well, that's very exciting. And it's music to my ears because most of my career, my experience is in B2B software, B2B SaaS.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
A lot of my kind of investment thesis evolves around that, the seed stage, the B2B software, B2B SaaS, and also focusing more on kind of the overlooked, underrepresented, immigrant founders, so to say. Those are the three components that I focus on from investment perspective. So tell us a little bit more about kind of the thesis that you've been developing, something that you prescribe to, that maybe a little bit more color from that standpoint.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the spaces I have definitely been looking at is future of work. I think even before the pandemic started, there were a lot more technologies coming out just addressing, I think, the single most important asset a lot of companies have, or I guess every company has, which is the people. So I think you've kind of seen, you know, some larger players in the space, starting with kind of some of the applicant tracking systems like, you know, Greenhouse, as well as, Workday on the back end. And then there's kind of a lot of, you know, more, I guess, like gorillas in this space. And then on the sourcing end, there's kind of LinkedIn that everyone knows, and a bunch of those kind of smaller solutions as well. But I think the one area that I find really interesting is what happens after kind of after you join a company. So like how do you kind of like, you know, move up the your career trajectory, or how do you receive feedback? Like how do you kind of like stay engaged, especially in an environment that's nowadays like super remote or at least hybrid? So I think my thesis I've been working on is like what type of company will kind of address both the new paradigm as well as just bring a bunch of stuff together that's post employment engagement, as well as addressing things as such as, you know, remote work and kind of career trajectory and burnout as well. So I think that's kind of an interesting space. There's been a lot of different companies, some are more point solutions where they're kind of like, hey, like, you know, I'll monitor you like in Slack. And then, you know, you can kind of like tell me like feedback and it kind of parses through and generates like a little score on in terms of how burned out the employee is based on the responses. I think my personal thesis is a lot of these, very much so in other parts of the HR world too, are still kind of point solutions. And if someone can kind of figure out the full trajectory of like, how do I kind of almost like softwareize or, you know, like bundle together some of these elements into one platform, like that, I think whoever can do that in an effective way will be a really good kind of post-employment engagement type of software. And I think there's a lot of activity, which is great, but I have yet to see something that's kind of more comprehensive. So definitely kind of looking for that as I'm speaking to a bunch of companies.
Very interesting. And let me know your thoughts around kind of my perspective on the B2B side versus the consumer is, you know, as a multi-company founder myself, I also tend to observe and through a few years of investing is that majority of the founders who are serial entrepreneurs or who are, you know, maybe that's their second rodeo, a lot of them are, you know, starting the B2B companies where yep. usually initial founders, the very first time, focus a lot on the consumer side, D2C. Yep. So that's been kind of an interesting revelation for me throughout kind of the, you know, the activity that I've been part of. What is it that, you know, when you meet the founder for the very first time, obviously, if you're focusing on the enterprise, it's probably a little bit more of an accomplished founder, someone who had some type of success, or they coming from, you know, a fruitful career in the corporate sector, possibly.
Yeah.
What are some of the very initial ingredients that make you think, okay, this sounds, you know, very promising. Let me take that to the next level, to the next stage. Just talk a little bit more from that standpoint.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the single most important metric, especially at the early stages, is probably what a lot of people would call founder market fit. So I think especially with enterprise companies, to your point, there's a lot of different motions. Like you have to understand what's a bottoms up sale versus a top down sale. And if you're going to do a top down sale, like who do you even go to? Do you go to the CEO, the CFO? What stage companies are you targeting? And if you do all of that, like who do you kind of meet on the team? Like what does that selling motion look like? So I do think because of by virtue of just having to understand more of that B2B sales motion, it makes sense that some B2B founders are a little bit more experienced or have worked at a similar company themselves before to be able to really understand the pain point and kind of what it takes to get an organization to buy something and kind of go through that whole process. So I do think some of the early signs is just understanding the founder's background and kind of getting a sense for if they do have some sort of experience in the space that they're building a solution in, and you know, if they might be equipped to have kind of that unique insight or ability to really execute on the idea. And I think it's not, you know, impossible for someone who hasn't worked in enterprise, like at an enterprise company, to maybe have a really unique insight from the outside or to maybe kind of like extrapolate what their experience would be like. But I do think often the more compelling founders have either kind of experienced the pain point by themselves, like for a number of years, or they kind of have like an amalgamation of different experiences that really informs what they're doing. So I think that's super important. And then I guess the other part too is, I think what some questions that I always ask is just kind of around the market landscape. So for example, like this sounds almost a little bit silly, but I always ask like, who are your competitors? Even though like I might know who they are, because I want to know if they understand the landscape, if they kind of understand the nuances, especially if there are similar players, how they differentiate. So it's definitely a red flag to me if they can't answer the question, or they just say like, oh, we don't really have any, you know, competitors. Like I think every company has some sort of competitor, whether it's direct or not. So that's kind of like almost like an easy question to suss out, like how well, how knowledgeable the founder is about their own space. And I think the last thing is, I do think sometimes you can kind of tell when an opportunity or like when an idea is more opportunistic. So I do think sometimes, you know, you've got these like brilliant people and maybe they're like one day they're kind of just like cooking up some idea. And I think the idea could be really great, but it could be, you know, just because like they wanted to do something else or they kind of feel like this is like the next thing that they should move to. And I think that can be kind of sussed out as well. Like, I think you can kind of tell if someone's like really, really passionate about a space versus just kind of looking for like something to do or like a startup to build. So I do think to me, the founder product market fit, that deep fit is really important. And it's kind of a combination of, you know, relevant work experience, as well as like, do I feel like they can execute and really, you know, have unique insights in the space, as well as do I feel like they really understand on a deeper level, all the competitors and players within the space as well.
That's very interesting points that you're making. We actually had a conversation, more of a debate last night with a friend of mine who is a professional investor, just like yourself, around domain expertise versus domain insight, in the sense yeah. that for me personally, I prefer a founder who has that domain insight versus mm-hmm. that accumulated domain experience, where kind of my side of the debate was, if the founder says something that makes me, you know, write things down, that's okay, this is an interesting point about that particular market or that particular solution. I tend to value that a little bit more, in the sense that they may not necessarily be so biased around based on that past experience in terms of what they're building. So that was just an interesting dynamic that we've been talking about, which, you know, you've actually mentioned that. And then just overall, the founder market fit from that perspective is, for me, when I talk to founders, just following kind of that digital breadcrumbs and their past history, what they've done before, is always fascinating to understand where they come from. But when we talk about that unfair advantage, right, where it's a big thing for me, that whatever the case is, what is your personal unfair advantage or your company or whatever the case may be, when you think about the unfair advantage, and you're trying to win deals, so you get access to, you know, perhaps a very competitive deal that's going on, how do you think about unfair advantage, or what is it that you bring to the table as an investor from the value add? Just share some thoughts around that.
Yeah, for sure. So I think my own, probably I would say, competitive edge is having come from the late stage world. So I think, you know, now that I'm an early stage, I know I want to be an early stage, but I wouldn't change the way that my trajectory went, because I do think I learned a lot of important analytical skills in later stage. And it was a more structured education around, okay, like, how do you kind of think about what a good company looks like and what are the metrics you should be looking for? So I do think, unlike someone maybe who started in early stage and has never really worked with late stage companies, I have that unique insight of, okay, like, I've worked with companies that have hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, their retention is this, like their growth is like this. So when you get to a certain size, like, what are some, you know, best in class metrics? And I think those are some really valuable insights that I can keep in the back of my head. And I don't think it's necessarily okay, like, remembering those numbers is really useful for seed stage investing, because there's just, as I'm sure you know, very little data at the early stages. But I do think it provides a really unique analytical framework to understand, okay, directionally, like, what do I feel like this company should look like, especially if it's a enterprise SaaS company, because I've looked at a lot of those previously at Vista, for example. So I do think kind of having that combination of late stage plus early stage is an interesting one, especially to be able to bring a viewpoint to portfolio companies as they're scaling up as well. And then I think from a company perspective, like from a fund perspective, we have a lot of really interesting people on the team, and they've also operated themselves. So I think one, they kind of know what it's like to be a founder. And then two, because everyone has such a diverse background, we all collectively have a really interesting network. So I think we're really able to leverage that on top of just providing a lot of the operational support in terms of just opening doors and then being able to connect people to kind of relevant other people in the industry as well. And then lastly, I would say both from kind of a firm as well as personal perspective, I think we're all very approachable. Like, I think to me, venture is basically, I think it's really interesting to me that I ended up in venture because I basically feel like I get paid to learn and meet new people, which is like stuff I would literally do for free. So I think it's really great to kind of have found a job that like literally encompasses what I like to do anyway. And whenever I talk to people, it just feels like I'm getting to know someone new. And I think everyone on the team kind of has the same approach. So, I mean, I think most investors are, you know, like pretty friendly and outgoing, but I do think there's kind of like a genuine interest in other people here, which I think makes it a lot easier to get exposure to all different types of founders, which is great as well.
Very, very insightful. When we talk about deal flow and, you know, building that, you know, your funnels and your channels of the sources where you get, you know, a consistent inflow of high quality founders, what strategies or maybe practical recommendations? Aside, obviously, your company has a brand name and there's probably recognition from that standpoint, founders reaching out. Anything aside that maybe you had seen that was pretty interesting in the sense that, wow, I get a pretty consistent, high quality deal flow from maybe that source. How do you approach overall the deal flow in general?
Yeah, for sure. So I would say for me, it boils down to one thing, which is a little bit counterintuitive, because I do think this is a challenge in venture where nobody has enough time and there's always like 1,000 meetings that you could do. But I think my personal advice is to just be generous with your time, because I do think venture is all about kind of meeting the right people at the right time. And you never really know who down the line might be, you know, relevant for something that you're working on, or you might be like helpful to them. So I think, you know, for me, I have these kind of broadly defined buckets that I want to try to implement for my pipeline. Like, I'm more focused on B2B. So I try to connect with more B2B investors, especially in New York. And I'm a seed stage investor. So I look at a lot of accelerators. But I do think, you know, beyond those things, there's all sorts of kind of fortuitous connections you can make. So I'm always open to meeting new entrepreneurs and other VCs as well, even if they don't seem like they're super directly relevant at the time, because I do think down the line, it kind of all comes together to create that better network, as you were mentioning. And then I think the other thing is just to be kind of, I think the other thing that's helpful is to be a little bit more kind of thesis driven when you do have time. So I do think seed investing is very volume driven. Like, there's a lot of interesting stuff coming in all the time. And I don't think you can kind of like, you know, only be thesis driven, in my personal opinion. But I do think, you know, when there's like a block on your calendar, it's nice to kind of listen to podcasts or, you know, talk to other people to kind of understand where some interesting areas might be, and then to kind of proactively go after those sectors and surface names that could be interesting for the pipeline as well. So I think it's a combination of just staying pretty open to different types of conversations, and then really like genuinely getting to know both investors and other entrepreneurs, so that at some point you can kind of exchange ideas and kind of keep the flow going as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. When it comes to you, so you've mentioned a lot of meetings, being very generous with your time, which is always a challenge for everybody. It's all about, yeah, you know, making time. When I hear people saying, I don't have time, it's just a matter of, you know, do you want to make time for that particular, right, person or for that particular meeting, whatever the case may be. So yeah, when you are in these meetings, I would imagine majority of the meetings are kind of the pitches from the founders, the presentations. Aside from the traditional kind of list of your go-to questions that, you know, probably founders, they hear that day in and day out as they meet with a lot of investors, right, what are some of the questions that maybe you have in your arsenal, kind of that are not so typical, that are not so traditional? What are those types of questions? And more importantly, what are you trying to get out of the founder when you ask those questions?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's a couple of different buckets. So I think especially if the founder has pivoted or there's some sort of, you know, change from before, I often kind of ask like, hey, like what made you realize like you needed to pivot, or how did you come to that decision? I'm less interested in like, you know, what the pivot was, or like why, I guess like why they had to. I mean, I think it's at the early stages, it's like very normal to have to pivot at some point, but I'm more interested in kind of their decision-making process, so that, you know, if they happen to pivot again, or, you know, if we're kind of more mainly betting on them as founders, like, what do I think is kind of, what do I think about the way they kind of like figured that out? Or do I kind of have confidence that they learned a lot from the first time? So I would say that's kind of one bucket. And then another question that I like to ask, and this usually comes out, but I do like to ask more explicitly, like how people know each other and what their relationship is like, especially if it's a co-founding team, just because I do think being a founder is not easy, especially in the early days. And I think people definitely make or break the company. So I think going deeper into just the team's background and really understanding the relationship and kind of observing almost the dynamics between them is really useful as well. I think that's a little bit of my psychology nerd speaking as well, but I do think you can tell a lot from just observing kind of how founders complement each other or the way they kind of like speak one after the other. I think, you know, these days it's harder because it's all over Zoom, but I think a lot of the relationship aspects are really, really important for the early stage as well.
Right. No, absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you on a lot of that. So speaking of which, the, you know, fully remote virtual environments we've all been for the past couple of years, not sure where, you know, what the next period is looking like. How are you preparing for that? So what are some of the things that maybe you do personally as far as, you know, building out your network, continue growing their relationships, you know, maybe with your portfolio founders or the new ones that you're trying to cultivate? Share any productivity hacks or anything from that perspective that really help you kind of bypass the whole concept of, you know, that's, yes, it's very tough being, you know, in fully remote environment. Yeah. What are some of the things that that really help you?
Yeah, so I have this super nerdy one, but basically when I first started venture, everything was entirely remote. So my first year in venture, it was 100% remote pretty much, but I still managed to meet hundreds of investors. And the reason I was able to, I think, is pretty simple. So I basically created this Google spreadsheet of every single person I had met, and I noted down all their details. It's like their name, their fund, what stage, what they're interested in, if they invest internationally. And then I think it's great to kind of be able to like send stuff back and forth. But if you, in my opinion, if I don't write it down, then I'll never remember like who's interested in what. So basically in that way, I just had a lot of Zooms, and then I would make sure to look at the list if I have relevant companies I want to send, whether they're portfolio companies or they're, you know, opportunities that I had seen, just new opportunities. And I would kind of send it to the people that I thought would be most interested, and kind of curated more of like a dialogue that way. And then actually it kind of came full circle, because when things started opening up, especially in New York, I was able to meet a lot of those people that I had only talked to virtually in person. And it was really great to kind of, you know, have gone from, you know, chatting every once in a while over Zoom to actually meeting up for a coffee. So I think really easy productivity hack is literally just to write everything down and kind of remember the details about everyone you met, because I do think people really appreciate it when you can actually, you know, like remember what they said and kind of tailor whatever you're sending to them. So yeah, I think in that way, like I would say, simply put, like create your own personal CRM, whether it's, you know, really clunky like me, like I do it just via Excel or Google, because it's just really easy. Like it's like an easy way to keep track of it. But I know other people like to use other software tools and stuff like that. But I think whatever it is, just kind of make your own CRM and always keep in mind, you know, the people you meet and try to go back to them with the relevant details as well.
So you've come from, you know, later stage company investments, which, you know, is a completely different, I guess, you know, approach just overall from the strategy in the sense that helping the company scale and grow from that standpoint.
Yep.
To now going to, you know, the seed stage at the very, very early stages of the companies. What were some of the findings, some of the things that you have discovered through those differences in terms of how you approach or even the growth tactics? And how did that impact the overall kind of your investment strategy? Just share some thoughts from that perspective in terms of that contrast between the, you know, the stages of where the company is at.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the biggest contrast is really kind of in like the stability of the business. So I think when you're an early stage company, there's a lot of ups and downs. Like one month you might have crazy revenue growth, and the next month you might have nothing. And then for later stage, presumably at that point, you've kind of figured it out, like, you know, revenue is like pretty steady, just to use a simple metric. And it's more about kind of optimizing some of the operational elements. But I do think one thing is kind of similar across both. So I do think the single most important thing that I've noticed in both late stage and early stage is just getting the right leaders in place for the company. So I think, you know, everyone kind of sees it for the early stage because it's so important to have the right founders, and then it's so important for them to add the right team members. But at the later stage, it's kind of the same problems. Like, for example, you know, no matter how great a company is doing at the later stage, it's really tough if they don't have a really good strategic CFO, or like it's like really hard to understand product roadmap stuff if they don't have a really good CTO, for example. So I do think one big learning from late stage that has applied to early stage is it's just very important to get the right people in place. And especially as the company is kind of starting to scale, like, you know, other aspects like the sales, or when it's no longer just founder-led sales, a lot of that is really important as well. So I would say that's one big thing. And then the other thing too is, I think in later stage, there's a lot more that you can kind of deep dive into in terms of, I guess, like cost structure. So in terms of, you know, like, how do we kind of improve, like, you know, our G&A so that we're not like, we're kind of like getting more EBITDA. Like, I think you can kind of afford to, you know, think about those like nitty gritty things at the late stage, because everything else is running a little bit more smoothly because the business is stable, as we were talking about. But, and I think one thing though that I learned is that, you know, at the early stage, of course, like, you don't need to get to like a perfect late stage number. Like, it's understandable for a B2B company, even a really good one, to be at like 60% gross margin, for example, when they're supposed to be at 80%. But I do think one really important learning is that it needs to be directionally correct. So there needs to be some path from early stage to late stage that shows, hey, there's the ability to go from, you know, wherever you are now to best in class, which is 80% gross margin. So I do think, you know, while the numbers don't have to exactly match what they are at the late stage, understandably, I do think there needs to be a trajectory to really understand the unit economics and whether there's kind of a smooth path to being able to eventually achieve that level of scale as well. So I think, you know, a couple of things would be, don't need to be exactly at where the late stage companies are at, but I think from a directional perspective, very helpful to be able to understand whether the company can eventually get there. And I think that's a good learning that I took from later stage as well.
Yeah, very interesting. It's probably, you know, such an interesting area that we could probably spend the rest of the, or even separate episode to talk about kind of the differences in the stages and the investment strategy from that perspective. But from your, you know, for you personally, what's next career-wise? What path are you trying to see the carve out for yourself? Whether that's staying in VC, and, you know, just share with us kind of some of your personal roadmap.
For sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, I do hope to stay for a long time at Lair, especially since I just joined. I think that would be great. There's lots of great mentors at the company, and I think I have a lot to learn for sure. But I do think, thinking super long term down the road, I do want to start my own fund one day. I think that will be a really good way to do something on my own, but still be an investor. I think I always tell people, like, I know 100% I want to be an investor, but I think some part of me also wants to almost experience a little bit of that entrepreneurial life too. So I think starting my own fund could be a really good blend of that down the line. But yeah, so that would be, I think, my ultimate goal.
Very exciting. As far as your content diets, what do you consume on a daily basis to stay ahead of the curve, to stay ahead of the competition? Share with us those sources.
Yeah. So my favorite book that I've read recently is actually called Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg. So it's really interesting. It's kind of like a blend of behavior psychology as well as, you know, technology too, because he gives a lot of examples in the tech world. But I do think it's just a generally helpful book for building new habits and for understanding, you know, what really kind of works for people from a behavioral basis. And I think I would encourage everyone to read it. I think it's super helpful for investors as well as founders alike.
Oh, that's a great recommendation. And on that particular note, the book that I just finished, just to add a little bit to that, it's called Super Founders.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Ali Tamaseb, I'm not sure if you heard of that. It's pretty interesting case studies and stories on some of the kind of his research into unicorns. And what are different attributes that really made up for that company to achieve that status? So that was kind of hand in hand with what you're talking about.
Yeah, definitely.
Mandy, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was a very short and insightful conversation for me, at least. I learned quite a bit. What I love doing with a lot of guests on the Ivy podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year to see where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies, and basically kind of talk from that perspective. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.